Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Animal Voices Show, which is, of course, earth-friendly and organic and biodegradable right here on CFRO 102.7 FM. You can also listen to us on the Internet at www.coopradio.org. My name is John Pranger, and I'm here with Marge Adams of the Humane Society. I represent the Animal Defense Society. The opinions expressed here are not necessarily those of the organizations that we represent, however. Well, let's see. We're going to be talking to two guests today. The first guest is Rakshana, who is a health researcher and activist in that field and in the politics of medicine. And in the second half of the show, we're going to be talking to Peter Fricker of the Humane Society and his recent trip to Ottawa in hearings held by the CFIA, the Canadian Food Inspection Agency. Let's start off with a quote, shall we? This is from a publication in Switzerland, Physicians Have the Word. And it has this statement in it from Doctor of Medicine Jörg Kim, who's a general practitioner in Zurich. He said, quote, "As a physician, I'm definitely opposed to animal experiments. They are totally useless. They don't contribute in any way to the progress of medicine. Animal experiments are just business and are usually associated with animal torture. Because of animal experimentation, modern medicine moves always farther away from humankind. This is obvious to every enlightened individual." Well, I guess I never tire of reiterating the fact that, according to the Food and Drug Administration, 1.5 million Americans are hospitalized almost every year as a consequence of taking drugs, which were supposed to cure them of something or other, and which have been thoroughly tested on animals, and then a little bit on people before they're actually marketed on a whole scale experiment on entire populations. And 30% of all hospitalized people get further damaged by the therapy that's imposed on them. The number of people killed in the USA by the intake of drugs has been estimated from anywhere from 140 to 220,000 every year. 220,000, yeah, every year. In fact, today the medical care industry is the second biggest industry in North America, exceeded only by food production and distribution. This situation is very similar in all industrialized countries whose citizens are amply protected by a health insurance system that encourages the use of drugs and expensive therapies and extracts from the gullible lower citizens billions in tax money that flow directly into the coffers of the chemo medical syndicate. So it's hardly a coincidence that during a 29-day physician strike in Israel in 1973, the national death rate was the lowest ever. According to statistics released by the Jerusalem Burial Society, the number of funerals dropped by nearly 50% on that occasion. The same thing happened in 1976 in Colombia when November marked the end of a 52-day strike by doctors in Bogota, the nation's capital. The National Catholic Reporter pointed out that during those 8 weeks, the death rate in Bogota went down 35%. The National Morticians Association of Colombia confirmed the fact. And the identical phenomenon came to pass a few years ago in California and in 1978 in Great Britain. So if doctors were really interested in prolonging people's lives, as they say they are, they might as well consider a perpetual strike and go fishing. As Dr. Robert Mendelsohn, the late Dr. Mendelsohn, the famed writing and practicing physician, suggested. But nothing seems able to shake the dogmatic conviction of the, I say, thoroughly brainwashed majority that medical art has never stood as high as today, and not even when a host of medical authorities tell them differently. And that includes, of course, vaccination and vaccines, which are touted as the savior of mankind virtually. So we're going to talk to Rakshana right now about these fundamental questions. How did you get involved in the issue of vaccination, Rakshana? Thanks for coming on the show.
Well, thank you, John. Well, I have to preface my comments by saying, first of all, that like most people, I was brought up and brainwashed and indoctrinated to believe that vaccines were the best thing next to apple pie. And so, you know, I never questioned vaccination. But in the early 1980s, as a classical ballet teacher, I started observing that post-vaccination, my students were not only more listless, less focused, but their coordination and motor skills were not up to what they had been previously. but I didn't pay that much attention. And then in the 1990s, a series of events happened that really opened my eyes and shook up the paradigm that I had been subscribing to. I personally had a serious vaccine reaction, and of course the experts, like usual, did not connect the dots, even though it was clearly related to the vaccine, and I had to be the one to, you might say, really remedy my own health, because they were making things worse for me. My dog had a very serious vaccine reaction, and I firmly believe that is what led to her death, which we can talk about later. And very interestingly, and a real eye-opener, was when I visited a school in India that was specifically for crippled children, where the vast majority of those children got polio following the polio vaccine. Now, this really shook me to the core, because we've been all taught that, you know, polio was basically conquered by vaccination. And these children varied in age, and it wasn't that it was one bad batch. We're dealing with a number of children, a school full of children, and these were the lucky ones who happened to be, you know, basically at this school. And there are still cases coming out to this day, many cases linking the polio vaccine in India and elsewhere with polio, and of course with death in children. And I see, you know, in my day-to-day life and in my practice as a teacher, where I get to observe children, I see so many obvious connections with vaccine damage. I have students who will not come to class following the Hep B vaccine because part of their body is paralyzed for 10 days. I mean, this is not boosting your immune system. There is a woman I know on welfare, and she told me how prior to her child having her last set of vaccine, she had 100-word vocabulary. That child today is saying 2 words. Now, do you think her case is being recorded? Absolutely not. Her doctor will not make the connection. He's in denial, like a lot of doctors are. Her sister's a nurse saying, oh, well, maybe it's a coincidence. I mean, this is rubbish, and it's an insult to parents, and it's the arrogance of science twisted and turned backwards that we say, oh, this is just anecdotal. I mean, what is more blatant than seeing your child change overnight? And it's really an insult. This, I think, is part of the mentality where we have been seduced into blindly heeding officialdom and the so-called experts, many of whom really come from this, from an in-the-box, reductionist, outdated mode of thinking. And so we really need to free ourselves and say, you know, anecdotal, look, this is, it's like saying your life is anecdotal, your happiness is anecdotal, prove it. I mean, this is what counts, is what we see happening day after day, and I can relate so many stories, but we have to get into other issues. So I think this is really important to discuss. To me, the proof is in the pudding. When you see that kind of dramatic change, and it clearly is not related to any other factor.
Yes, anecdotal is a far better guide than experiments on monkeys. Now, they say, well, it's been proven on monkeys, therefore we can now try it on people. It's safe for monkeys, therefore people being very much like monkeys, or at least, they're similar enough, whatever, who cares. That's the proof that they want. That's the proof that they offer, and anecdotal evidence becomes somehow nullified. Now, if harm is proven, how is benefit proven? And does it mean that some people are expendable?
Mm-hmm. Well, what really irks me is this mantra we hear repeated over and over again, blindly, the benefits outweigh the risks. Now, granted, the vast majority of people involved in the medical profession are well-intentioned and, you know, bright, caring people. Unfortunately, I think, again, they've been seduced by historical deception and being part and parcel of sort of a system that is in denial and where there's conflicts of interest. There have been no long-term studies comparing vaccinated versus non-vaccinated populations. There's no long-term flowchart. For them to say this, it's absolutely outrageous. These vaccines are not tested for their carcinogenic nor mutagenic potential. They do not look long-term for autoimmune disease. And they will say on their inserts, you know, often they'll say, well, there is, you know, such and such a chance that this could, for example, with a Hep B, lead to multiple sclerosis. Well, those tests and those, you know, trials are based on ridiculously short amount of time. You know, studies which last days, you develop multiple sclerosis after, you know, a significant amount of time. And then when I hear that, you know, vaccines are conclusive, and this comes out of our Vancouver Coastal Health, I've dealt with several people there, and they say there's no debate around vaccines. Well, this flies completely in the face of reality, of what's happening. According to the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, which is seriously flawed, and it's well noted that even by CDC and FDA admission, that only a small percentage of actual vaccine damage is reported, a very minuscule percentage. Well, between 1991 and 2002, 245,000 reports of possible vaccine damage came through VARS, and that included about 5,775 disabilities and 5,300 deaths. Now, this, again, is a very small percentage of what is happening. Most doctors do not connect the dots, or they do not want to admit to vaccine damage. To say there is no controversy, again, flies in the face of what is happening. If there's no controversy, why did France ban the Hep B vaccine? Why have several European countries stopped the pertussis vaccine? Why have there been congressional hearings on vaccines? What has happened with anthrax alone and the link between Gulf War syndrome? Yes, Gulf War, definitely the depleted uranium plays a major factor, very toxic, other factors as well. But there were soldiers who were not deployed to Iraq who also came down with Gulf War syndrome, which is a terribly debilitating situation, and they got the anthrax vaccine. You know, this is part and parcel of what basically comes under the guise of, well, you know, the vaccine is innocent till proven guilty. And, you know, over and over again, there's a vaccine critic, and what's interesting is his name is Dr. Mark Randall. He previously worked for the National Institute of Health, and he was a vaccine developer, and he has grave misgivings now in his retirement about what he did, because he's really connected the dots and seen the damage. And he says over and over again, the problem is we assume vaccine safety, and we exonerate vaccines. And so when I talked about that little girl I know, she just is the tip of the needle. For, you know, every vaccine case that does go reported and get some sort of compensation, and it's very, very low, there are so many more. We don't know how many more that are just totally ignored and denied. And, you know, Dr. Randall pointed out that, for example, if a certain vaccine is given, let's say the measles vaccine or something, and we see a drop in measles on the surface, we say, oh, well, the vaccine is a success. But as he points out, the vaccine is harbored inside the body and can actually produce damage, leading to that disease at a later point, like atypical measles, which is only found in the vaccinated, very telling, or meningitis. So, in fact, to say that we are actually reducing disease and that this is cost-effective has no grounding in any type of scientific basis at all.
Dr. Mark Randall is the pseudonym, right, of a vaccine researcher?
Exactly. He is, and the reason he used that pseudonym is because he's become very well-versed in the politics of what happens when you speak out. There are a number of scientists in many fields who have been penalized for speaking out, and though he's in his retirement, he certainly wants to protect himself and, you know, basically his situation.
Oh, yeah.
But I also want to add that, you know, in the media, we have such an inbuilt vaccine bias that we cannot even see it because it's been with us for so long. And I'll give you two examples. January 11th, 2000, after reporting that 30 of the 32 patients at a senior's home who got the flu shot got the flu, BCTV's John Daly continues, it's not too late to get the flu shot. The vaccine is 70% effective. I mean, are people not listening to what they say? It just blows me away. It's such an obvious contradiction. And the flu vaccine is well worth going into maybe at a later date. Another example, January 10th, 2004, the New York Times reports that the Center for Disease Control recorded 93 infant deaths from the flu. New York Times' Lawrence Altman writes, 33 of the victims had not been vaccinated. The CDC recommends vaccination for all healthy children 6 months and older. He doesn't point out that 60 of the children were vaccinated. The majority of them were vaccinated against the flu. This is the typical twisting and apologizing for vaccine damage. The vaccine is inevitably exonerated. And just watch, you know, any TV news coverage given to vaccines. It will always be played in favor of the vaccine.
You can... people can access this interview with John Rapoport with Dr. Mark Randall. It's astounding what comes out in that interview, and it's can be found, I hope, still at www.nomorefakenews.com, and that's John Rapoport's website. Now, what about vaccine-induced disease called VIDS? Is that right?
That's right. You know, far from being safe and effective, all around us are examples abounding of children who are increasingly immunocompromised. I pointed out before the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, which is incredibly flawed, and the reports come in maybe at a trickle of what they should be, but even there we have, you know, huge numbers of vaccine damage cases. With the Hep B case through the VAERS system, we have 36,000 reports of serious complications and over 440 deaths from the Hep B vaccine, which they toot as a modern vaccine and the safest vaccine. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. And again, these are not updated stats, and they reflect a very small percentage, perhaps, of what is happening because we don't get the big picture. But I'll just outline in no particular order, because there are hundreds of studies that pinpoint or point to at least vaccines being a significant factor in a number of diseases, especially autoimmune disease. So I'll just briefly sort of allude to some of these and other studies. Dr. Harris Coulter, brilliant scholar. He was so brilliant, people would actually refuse to come out and debate him. They couldn't find people to debate him. He wrote A Shot in the Dark and a number of other books. And he did decades of research and work showing the impact of vaccination on the developing brain and the link to developmental, behavioral, and attention deficit disorders, which, of course, are now epidemic in the U.S. We have children, we have toddlers now being diagnosed with bipolar. Now, we can't, you know, just say, well, this is part of their diet. Yes, other things could be happening, but clearly, I think based on his research, which has been going on for decades, and a lot of other research, we have to connect the dots. What's interesting is in Australia, prior to mandating vaccines in the school system, there actually was, you know, there was a normal sort of range of behavioral problems or this or that. Since then, it has skyrocketed. Since they've mandated vaccination, of course, there are always exemptions and whatnot, they have seen a huge increase in behavioral and learning disabilities. Do you think they're connecting the dots? It's like, how obvious do these things have to be? We don't need neurotoxins injected into our bodies, so the cumulative effect of which, you know, is playing out now. The work of world-leading immunogeneticist Hugh Frudenberg, linking five consecutive flu shots with a tenfold increase risk for Alzheimer's. Dr. Bart Klassen, immunologist, who's done work, extensive work, showing that vaccine is the largest cause of insulin-dependent diabetes. And the New Zealand Journal of Medicine reported an 80% increase in diabetes following the Hep B program. Considerable research by a brilliant researcher, Dr. Vera Schreibner, on the link between vaccines and SIDS, which was almost unheard of pre-vaccination. A study in The Lancet in 95 showing that those who received the measles vaccine were 2.5 times more likely to develop ulcerative colitis and 3 times more likely to develop Crohn's. In 1994, JAMA published, Journal of American and Medical Association published data showing children diagnosed with asthma were 5 times more likely to have received the pertussis vaccine than not. In a study by the Annals of Rheumatic Disease, 55% of women vaccinated against rubella developed arthritis within 4 weeks. Of course, many of us have heard of the controversy around the SV40 cancer-inducing virus found in the polio vaccine, which has been found in human tissues and tumors, and this is through research, 62 papers coming from 30 laboratories around the world. Of course, there's Dr. Andrew Wakefield, his explosive work showing the link between the MMR vaccine and autism. And, of course, his work was so explosive that they had to hunt him down. This is a man whose work has been replicated. They don't tell you that. And yet there was basically a concerted effort to discredit him, as happens with other issues like genetically engineered foods and other scientists. And his work has been replicated. And yet, of course, it was the vaccine interest behind the MMR that made sure that there were media spins and all the rest to discredit his work. Now, interestingly enough, you have to ask, why is it the Amish children don't get autism? Well, by and large, they don't get vaccinated. And only the ones who do get vaccinated are the ones who are candidates for autism. You do not find autism in non-vaccinated Amish children. Now, I cannot validate the worthiness of all of these studies, but I think we have to bear in mind there is no money or advancement to be found in vaccine criticism. And more importantly, I think we need to turn the tables and ask, where is their science? Where are their long-term studies? Why don't they conduct proper studies where there's a non-vaccinated group? They compare vaccines by comparing one vaccine with the foreign animal DNA and then and all of the components, and the other vaccine just with the stabilizers, neurotoxins, and preservatives in it. I mean, this is not science. They change definitions. For example, it will not be qualified as a seizure if in the study someone reacts and they have a seizure for 20 minutes. It will not qualify because it did not last 30 minutes. I mean, this is ridiculous. They don't look for carcinogenic or mutagenic potential, autoimmune dysfunction over the long term. The studies are appallingly short, and of course we know studies can be designed to basically prop up whatever you want. So, I mean, it's ridiculous, the whole thing. We need to turn it around and say, you know, why isn't the precautionary principle applied to vaccination? Why do we assume, foolishly, irrationally, that the injection of harmful preservatives, stabilizers, putrid substances, animal DNA, rogue viruses, and retroviruses is going to improve the health of a child? And then they have the gall to say, well, you'll be exposed to mercury by eating a tuna sandwich. Well, that may well be, but at least with a tuna sandwich, it goes through your digestive tract and their filtration systems. Here we are, we're actually injecting directly into the body all of these known neurotoxins and carcinogens, and I think it's borderline criminal.
So do I, and so does Dr. Mendelsohn, by the way, who was, of course, a professor of medicine and a very famous writing doctor. He said there's never been a single vaccine in this country that's ever been submitted to a controlled scientific study.
Mm-hmm.
Never took a group of 100 people who were candidates for a vaccine, gave 50 of them a vaccine, left the other 50 alone, and
mm-hmm.
measured the outcome. And
mm-hmm.
since, he says, that's never been done, that means if you want to be kind, you call vaccines an unproven remedy. If you want to be accurate, you'll call the people who give vaccines quacks.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting to point out that Dr. Mendelsohn said that there has been no effort whatsoever to find out what becomes of this foreign DNA in the body. I mean, what sort of experiment are we conducting? And this
That's
is...
Right.
It's just mind-boggling.
Well, and the SV40 virus is now showing up in the brains
mm-hmm.
of people who are, in fact, dying of tumors of the brain.
Yes.
Isn't that right?
Mm-hmm. That's right, yes.
Now, there was a story in 1986, the polio paradox. It came out in a newspaper. No, it came out in Science magazine. And it talked about the polio paradox. One of two polio vaccines, it said, has been largely abandoned in the U.S. The other is the leading cause of the disease.
Mm-hmm.
What was wrong? And Sabin, or rather Salk, made a princely fortune, and so did Sabin, and yet each accused the other of killing their patients, and each accused the other that their particular vaccine is dangerous and deadly.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, it's interesting because I have a quote from Dr. Sabin here, and he said, quote, official data shows that large-scale vaccination has failed to obtain any significant improvement of the diseases against which they were supposed to provide protection. I think this is what, you know, is the Trojan horse of the whole vaccine model. And it's what is used to push vaccines, you know, and scare people into vaccination. Well, polio and smallpox, these were basically eradicated because of vaccination. And this is just complete historical fraud. Between 1923 and 1953, before the Salk-Killed virus vaccine was introduced, the polio death rate in the U.S. and England had already declined on its own by 47% and 55% respectively. Now, this is particularly interesting. This is despite the fact that guess when polio started to skyrocket within within the course of these decades. It was after the diphtheria and pertussis vaccines were introduced. And this report comes right from the Lancet, April 18, 1950, that in fact, polio was made worse by the introduction of these vaccines. So this, I think, is very revealing. We know that polio declined in Europe where the vaccine wasn't available, or in countries it wasn't used in, and it declined at the same rate. And it showed here, for example, in 1955, the New England Journal of Medicine published a study showing that children who receive a single injection within 1 month after receiving a polio vaccine were 8 times more likely to contract polio than children who received no injections of the diphtheria. So we can see that there's considerable considerable misinformation regarding polio and smallpox. By and large, when we look at serious diseases and we look at things like diphtheria, tetanus, etc., all of these things were in significant decline prior to vaccination.
Now, due to the introduction of hygiene and so on.
Absolutely. Better hygiene, proper sanitation, pure drinking water, better living conditions, standards of living, better nutrition. All of these things significantly contributed to the betterment of human health prior to the advent of vaccines. There was a combined 90% drop in the measles, whooping cough, diphtheria, and scarlet fever rates of death prior to any vaccines for these diseases being introduced. Now, what's interesting is, and this is the real smoking gun, is when people bring up polio and smallpox, well, lo and behold, there was a vaccine that was created for scarlet fever, and people did die of scarlet fever, I mean, but it was never used. Now, you don't hear about, you know, the massive epidemics or outbreaks of scarlet fever. How did that get accomplished minus vaccines? And yet we look at measles, and measles, in most cases, is not at all a serious disease. It's only when the child's immune system, such as in the third world, is highly compromised. But we look at measles, we've gone from one measles strain to instead, post-vaccination, we now have 12 measles strains, and atypical measles, which can only be contracted by the vaccinated, which is very interesting, came on the scene at the time of the measles vaccine. And so, you know, this is a real eye-opener. Now, atypical measles, of course, is very serious, and it has a much, much higher death rate than measles, which has a very, very low death rate. So again, are we sowing the seeds of our own destruction? And why is it, you know, we don't learn any of this through our mainstream media? But going back to the polio vaccine, I just want to read some
yeah, we
quotes.
Have to be quick about it because we're almost out of time. We've got 3 minutes, all right?
Well, okay. I hold the stock vaccine and its manufacturers responsible for the polio outbreak that killed people in Idaho and hospitalized dozens more. And Salk himself said, when you inoculate children with a polio vaccine, you don't sleep well for 2 or 3 weeks. One day perhaps we can get into smallpox, but the cover-up regarding the smallpox vaccine is enormous, too. They say it was decimated because of the vaccine. Well, there was only 10% of the world's population that was vaccinated against smallpox, and yet we see the major outbreaks occurred post-vaccination in the Philippines, the worst epidemic, which killed thousands.
Several epidemics.
Oh, yes, happened after the vaccine was given. And so it's huge. I mean, the amount of cover-up with the smallpox. And I'll just see if I can quickly read a quote here or two. Oh, dear.
If I may, this pseudo-vaccine, like Sabin's and Salk's, which recognizes being the sole cause of polio, almost destroyed an entire species of animals, the highly sensitive and intelligent rhesus monkey.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what are they going to do? Now they're trying out an AIDS vaccine on chimps and threatening their survival.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, as you say, polio practically disappeared in all those countries where no vaccination took place, and they were spared, of course, the huge damages that the vaccination
mm-hmm.
caused.
And what's interesting is that actually Salk himself testified in 76 that almost all the cases of polio that had happened in the States between, you know, 1960 and up until that point were related to the vaccine. And according to the CDC, 133 people contracted polio between 1980 and 1994. A total of 125 of those cases, or an average of 8 per year, were caused directly or indirectly by the oral polio vaccine.
Well, just like everything else in nature, illness exists within a larger context of a balanced system. There's an ecology of human illness. And if we attempt to eliminate a single element of any ecological system, we have found out to our peril that we disturb the whole balance and in ways that can only lead to unforeseen consequences. I'm sorry we have to end it there. I appreciate very much the information that you've given us today, Rakshana.
Thank you.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
All right, that was Rakshana, who's an independent health researcher and researcher into the politics of medicine, and what a can of worms that is. We're going to go for a little break, and then we'll be back with Peter Fricker and Marge Adams.
Oh, I'd go anywhere to fight for oil, be it olive, safflower, or crude. For cooking, for cars, take a rocket to the stars, for a back rub, romantic rendezvous. In your engine, on your face, or almost any place, a little dab of oil will get you through. Oh, I'd go anywhere to fight for oil, to lubricate the red, white, and blue. If you drive a big V8, it's time to celebrate. They're gonna fight a war for you to keep gas prices cheap, so when you drive or when you sleep, you can do it in an air-conditioned room. For driving is your right, so let's get out there and fight. You can read that in the Constitution. I go anywhere to fight for oil, to lubricate the red, white, and blue. Here we go now. I go anywhere to fight for oil, be it olive, safflower, or crude. For cooking, for cars, take a rocket to the stars, for a back rub, romantic rendezvous. In your engine, on your face, or almost any place, a little dab of oil will get you through. Oh, I'd go anywhere to fight for oil, to lubricate the red, white, and blue. Place to attack, why not attack Iraq? They've got coconut and palm oil and crude. They invaded Kuwait, so let's not hesitate. We can blow up a country or two. If it's oil or it's Greece, we don't have time for peace. Waging war is what we want to do. Oh, I'd go anywhere to fight for oil, to lubricate the red, white, and blue.
Everybody!
I'd go anywhere to fight for oil, be it all in safflower crude. For cooking, for cars, take a rocket to the stars, for a back row romantic rendezvous. In your engine, on your face, or almost any place, a little dab of oil will get you through. Oh, I'd go anywhere to fight for oil. It's gonna be a great fight, should only take a fortnight to lubricate the red, white, and blue.
Oh, thank you. I want to introduce our next guest, who is going to be on the telephone with us. His name is Peter Fricker, and he's the Projects and Communications Director for the Vancouver Humane Society. Peter Fricker and Deborah Cote-Probert, who is the Executive Director of VHS, returned from a meeting in Ottawa with three veterinarians from the Canadian Food Inspection Agency just a few days ago, and I want to have Peter tell us about that meeting. Hello, Peter, are you there?
Yes, Marge, hi there.
Welcome to Animal Voices.
Thanks very much.
I hear you had an interesting meeting with the veterinarians in Ottawa. Can you tell us what it was all about?
Yes, certainly. I suppose I should start by just giving a bit of background. Your listeners will recall that back in the spring of 2004, we had that outbreak of avian flu in the Fraser Valley, which resulted in the slaughter of about 17 million birds, that's chickens and ducks and geese and so on. And large numbers of those birds were depopulated, is the term the CFIA uses, by the use of carbon dioxide gas. And at the time, we were very concerned that that wasn't the most humane method available. And we, along with the Canadian Coalition for Farm Animals, strongly complained to the agency about the method and some of the other things they were doing. And at that time, they just refused to listen to any of our concerns or consider any of the alternatives that we and experts that we had contacted were suggesting. So from those very early days of the outbreak and in the months following, we did a lot of research into the methods, into the alternatives that were available, and we published a report which, again, in great detail pointed out to the CFIA what the problems were with CFIA, with the carbon dioxide gas, the scientific opinion around the world that called their methods into question. And again, we were continuously stonewalled. Then early this year, a parliamentary committee, the Parliamentary Agriculture Committee, held hearings into the entire outbreak, including some of the methods that were used. And it emerged from those hearings that there had been, just as we had suspected, some disastrous results from the use of carbon dioxide gas. In particular, farmers were testifying that up to 100,000 ducks and geese had died agonizingly slow death as a result of the failure of the carbon dioxide gas to work properly. And also stories of horrendous stories of chickens being beaten to death with hockey sticks when the gas failed in that instance as well. So we felt certainly that we were vindicated in our suspicions, and we continued to correspond with officials. We tried to get the issue into the media with some success, and we just kept plugging away. Eventually, we wrote an open letter on behalf of the CCFA, the Canadian Coalition for Farm Animals, to the Federal Minister of Agriculture, calling for an inquiry, because we felt that despite what was coming out, there still wasn't enough investigation into this happening. We got a lot of support from that letter. We got the support of the Provincial Agriculture Minister, John Van Dongen, who agreed to meet us about our concerns, and he thought they were perfectly valid, and on our behalf he wrote himself to the Federal Minister, Andy Mitchell, in Ottawa, supporting our claims and asking for a review into the methods to be done. So things started to pick up. What we got back from the Federal Agriculture Minister, Andy Mitchell, was a request that we meet with his officials. He wouldn't meet with us himself, but he said we could meet with three senior CFIA officials in Ottawa, and that was last week on the 10th of June, and we went to Ottawa to meet those officials, and we were quite pleased with the result in that despite all the denials and stonewalling that had taken place before, all our efforts finally got us somewhere, because what they have agreed to do is to conduct a reassessment of the methods that were used and do some new research on new methods, look at alternatives to carbon dioxide, and basically meet one of our central demands. So we were extremely pleased that they were beginning to listen and that the denials had ended, and there was an admission that indeed there was a problem and that something new needed to be tried.
So you've really got humane treatment of animals on the radar screen with the CFIA, I guess, huh?
Yes, it was an extremely frustrating process, and of course, you know, we're going to continue to monitor the situation. They have made this commitment, but We're really interested in deeds rather than words, so we will see what actually happens over the next year. What the timetable they've laid out is that they will conduct this research over a period of a year, and then publish a report, which will be made public, so we'll be able to look at it. And then, depending on their findings, they will base new procedures in the event of a slaughter required by an outbreak of disease. And those will be put in place, and we are obviously hoping that they'll be a lot better and more humane than the methods that were used last year.
Yeah, it was possible, even at the time that this was going on, to use more humane gas methods, wasn't it, in 04?
Yes, our view, and this is backed up by a number of experts and scientific research, is that carbon dioxide is not the best way to slaughter the chickens humanely, that it's probably a mixture of gases, and this is certainly used in other countries where gases such as argon or nitrogen or mixes of those gases with carbon dioxide could be more humane. What the CFIA is saying it will do now is that it will test those different mixtures in different situations, sort of realistic on-site situations where they will pump gas into a barn and see whether that can be done quickly enough and effectively enough and achieve a very quick and humane death for the animals.
Are they just going to be animals, healthy animals that are going to be used? Is that the idea? I hate to see more of them die.
Yes, well, our understanding is that they'll probably apply it where a farmer has asked for a depopulation to take place for some other reason. Obviously, in the case where of egg-laying hens, where they're spent hens, they would go for slaughter in any case, and it may be that they'll use that opportunity to try these different gas mixtures out inside a barn.
Which would probably be more humane than the present slaughter methods in the
Ironically, that's the case, because when they're normally being sent for slaughter, one of the worst things is that they are handled, transported, then they would go to a slaughterhouse, be shackled, go through a stun bath, an electric stun bath, which may or may not work, and then have their throat slit. And again, that's not always consistent in killing the birds or either. So certainly having the birds stay in situ and have gas applied, if it's the correct mixture of gas, is likely to be much more humane than traditional slaughter.
I see. One of the problems was the leaky barns, wasn't it, with CO2?
Yes, and they're telling us that they learned a lot during that last outbreak about sealing the barns up properly. They faced, obviously, various kinds of operational difficulties, for example, where a farmer may have a half-open barn, and it's going to take some time to try and find a way to seal that up appropriately for putting the gas in.
Was the incident of the slaughter well recorded for study?
No, and this is one of the disappointments in our meeting. The two other things we were asking, aside from new research and a review of the methods and new protocols to result from those methods, we had asked that they agree to third-party independent observers in case of another such outbreak or similar or even a different disease. And they wouldn't agree to that. What we were hoping they would agree to is having someone from the SPCA or an independent vet appointed by the SPCA. The problem they said that they had with that was that in the event of an emergency, they felt it was just one more step and one more concern that their staff would have to take on, and that wouldn't be their number one priority. They also were a little bit sensitive that we were suggesting that the CFIA wasn't trustworthy or competent enough to take on that responsibility themselves. What we pointed out was that we thought, in fact, it would be to their advantage in the case of a very public emergency to have independent observers in place who could attest to either the success of what they were doing, or at least they would be able to agree with the CFIA that there were problems and give them some help in explaining those problems. They took some of that on board, but they still wouldn't commit to third-party observers being present. They did suggest that each individual province had the power through its own emergency plans to appoint a role for the SPCA in such an emergency, in which case it might be possible for a provincial government to mandate that responsibility. So it's still possible that we might get that, but probably through another route.
I think you also asked to have videotapes taken.
Yes, and again, they were reluctant to do that. One of the things they pointed out was that they certainly agreed that they wished they had done more videotaping than they did in that first that outbreak. They only did one videotape, which was inconclusive. And again, they said it was because they were concentrating on so many other things that they hadn't made a priority. They said next time they would certainly want to do more videotaping, but they couldn't commit to releasing those tapes to the public, they had a concern that different groups, such as ourselves, I suppose, would interpret the film differently than they would, and I guess they were a bit concerned about different people having different opinions about what was actually happening. There were also some technical problems they alluded to, which is when the gas goes in the barn, it does completely fog up the barn and you're not able to see much. They suggested that they were hoping to get infrared equipment, which would allow them to see what was actually going on. But again, there was this reluctance to release the tapes. I think in what we would do in that case is what we did in the first outbreak, was simply use a request under the Freedom of Information Act to try and obtain those tapes.
I see. So that would be a possibility. And did you have any success? You said there was one tape made.
Yes.
Did you have a chance to see that one?
We did, and we used a Freedom of Information request to get that tape. And again, it was very difficult to see what was going on because of the fog simply obscured the chickens in the barn. There was some change in the vocalization from the chickens, but it was difficult to say whether, with certainty, that indicated that there was an increased distress amongst the chickens. Even the CFI admitted that you know they would have liked to have got a better view, and one of them apparently did make an attempt to you know suit up in a biosecure suit to try and have a look, but he was restrained by his colleagues simply because it was unsafe. So there was an indication on their part that they had a sincere desire to find out whether the methods were humane or not. In those two particular instances, the videotaping and the third-party observation, we weren't particularly happy with their response. But the main commitment, which is that an admission that they had done that the methods were not as good as they should have been, and that they have committed to researching better methods and improving their procedures, was something that we were quite happy to hear. But again, we are going to monitor that work and see what comes out in the end.
Is there a group to be set up very soon in order to get the work underway?
Yes, they are setting up a working group to carry out this study, and it will include not only their own experts but external people, including some senior scientists such as Ian Duncan, who is the leading expert on chicken welfare in Canada, and other groups. They said they would involve and possibly involve the Animal Welfare Foundation of Canada and the Federation of Humane Societies. So we were quite pleased that they were willing to open that up to outside expertise.
And that with this group, it would be animal welfare would be their primary concern. Is that right?
That's right. They said that was the intention, was to find the most humane methods, but they did say that they would also have to look at other criteria in terms of it being practical, feasible, and they said cost would be a factor as well.
I see. I guess those things are always hold true.
Yes. Yeah. So we do need to watch that. You know that what they say is actually going to be carried out.
Right. It'll have to be monitored, won't it, to make sure this in fact does happen. And I'm sure that you and Deborah Probert will be on the job.
Absolutely, we'll keep our eye on them. The other thing I should mention, which was also encouraging, is that they did describe this work as a first step, and that is that they would look at improving humane slaughter for poultry in disease outbreaks, but their intention was to do similar work for other species, that is, other farm animals.
Mm-hmm. And I guess your whole meeting centered on the slaughter issue. You didn't go into prevention or anything of a future outbreak or how the different types of farming influences the health of the animals. And those were
in this case, we focused very specifically on improving the depopulation method so that they would be more humane. But those are other issues that, you know, we're certainly not going to let go of, and we'll be pursuing them on those things as well.
Right, and I'm sure that with your meeting and with the interest shown by the CFIA that it's going to convince politicians of public concern about animal welfare, food animal welfare, let's say.
Yeah, we think it was a good sign that the Federal Agriculture Minister, Andy Mitchell, was willing to put those very senior CFIA people forward to meet with us. They basically, I guess, had no choice in the matter once he had said that that they were the people to meet with. And I think that tells us that that politicians are beginning to recognize that Canadians really do care about animal welfare, and they're not going to let these kind of issues go. And we're really pleased that a lot of our supporters wrote to the minister and have supported us throughout this whole piece of work.
Now, John has a question for you, Peter.
Sure.
Maybe a little bit off topic, but, you know, millions of tax dollars are being used to prop up factory farming. Did any disease break out in the organic farms? We're talking about avian flu now, right?
Yes, that's right. There's some dispute over that. They say that there were 11 of the what so-called backyard farms that were found to have to be positive in finding avian flu. But we know from speaking to experts within the provincial government, avian flu biologists, that in fact wasn't the case, and their claim was that in fact there was only one out of the total that were looked at. So whichever way you look at it, our view is that this was purely a problem originating from the intensive farming operations and spread to the backyard farms, and in fact most of those were found not to be positive in any case.
Gives a lie to the idea then that wild birds actually were the original cause of the outbreaks. Is that right?
My understanding is that although wild birds have been carriers, they are not to blame. What is really to blame is that however the virus emerged in the initial farm, and that was an intensive farming operation, the problem was that it mutated very quickly because of the density in the barn. And it's the mutation that is so dangerous, and the very fast spread that is the problem, and that's purely down to the numbers of birds packed into those barns. In our view, it stems directly from the type of farming that's being carried out.
Yeah, and those diseases are virtually unstoppable once they break out, eh?
Pretty well. I mean, that's why they end up having to do these mass slaughters.
Thank you so much for this, Peter. We appreciate having you on the show today and telling us about this very important food animal issue. I think we're out of time now, so once again, thanks a lot.
Thanks much.
I wonder, Peter, could you hang on a minute?
Yeah, sure.
We got another minute here. Now, the Beyond Factory Farming Coalition, which is based in Saskatoon, mm-hmm. has a campaign to write to the ministers, the Honorable Andrew Mitchell, who's Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada,
yep.
and the Honorable John Van Dongen, Minister of Agriculture, Food and Fisheries in the province of in Victoria. Do you subscribe to that, or can this can we suggest to our listeners that they take part in this campaign?
I mean, we would certainly support that idea. I mean, we're not in a position to directly ask supporters to write on our behalf, but if other groups are doing that, we'd certainly support it.
Great. Well, it's www, for anybody who wants to know, www.beyondfactoryfarming.org, and you can download some form letters to send to the ministers and let them know your point of view.
Bye-bye, Peter.
Okay,
thanks.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to an interview with Peter Fricker, who's with the Vancouver Humane Society.
And that brings us to the end of another edition of Animal Voices, I guess, March. Do you have anything you have to add to this? Well, thanks very much, listeners, for listening. Our website, once again, is www.animalvoices.org. And you can find links to the Vancouver Humane Society there, to Earth Save Canada, and to the Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection Society, all participants in this broadcast. Our programs are also posted on the audio portion of our website, and you can listen to them there in case you miss it. And we'll also repeat this program on Monday. So thanks very much to our interesting guest, Peter Fricker of the Humane Society in Rakshana. Thanks very much for listening. I'm John Pranger.